Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Hemingway's Summer Poetry Series, and it's about, well, Hemingway's Summer Poetry Series.
Yeah.
And our guests for this episode are some folks who know something about Hemingway's Summer Poetry Series, the co-curators Joan Bauer and Christopher Collins.
Hey, Matt.
Hey. So,
Hi, Matt.
Hello. So, I guess the best place for us to start is, so, for the folks who are in Pittsburgh or not in Pittsburgh, what the hell's the Hemingway's Summer Poetry Series?
It's the longest-running poetry series in Pittsburgh, probably in Pennsylvania. It was founded by Jimmy Savatic in about 45 years ago.
Yeah, supposedly around 1975.
Yeah, around 1975. And it was created because Pitt had a series that ran through the school year, and somebody needed to... there was an interest in having communities poets read during the summer, and Jimmy volunteered.
Yeah, Jimmy was kind of a neutral party. He wasn't part of the academic scene or any particular scene, so they felt, is it Ed Ochester or
Bruce Dover?
Bruce, who came, they went to Jimmy, I think, and asked if he'd be interested in hosting it because he was outside of all the other groups.
And it's especially interesting in that he had a pretty demanding day job. He was a homicide detective. He was actually an undercover narcotics officer. He had a pretty full life doing that and doing work with boxers, training, but he was also a very serious poet, read a lot of poetry and certainly wrote a lot.
Yes.
Lots. And so the series has gone on sort of nonstop from then, and as you know, as a lot of people know, he passed away in February, and so we, to be honest, Jimmy and I had worked on a plan for about 2 years because we knew he was really sick, and we didn't talk about it too much, but there was actually only one plan in terms of what would happen next, and the plan was that I would ask Chris Collins to be the co-curator. And that worked out because Chris said yes.
So there was no plan B.
And so.
Yeah.
So.
So, yeah, so I think, you know, and touching on something that I just started going to the Hemingway's Poetry last summer. I knew about it when I moved to Pittsburgh 18 years ago, and for some reason I just never got over there.
You didn't find us until then? Okay. All right.
Yeah, I know.
We're going to have to make up for that now and come every week for at least 2 years.
I'm trying, you know. I think
he's been good.
He's been good.
I've been good this year. I think
I'm
just one.
And you might get to carry some furniture, you know. We can enlist you. Put you to work.
Yeah, so what does it take? Actually, let me go on this route then, and we'll get to the other thing I was thinking about in a moment. So what does it take to keep a series running for 45 years?
I think for Jimmy it was just a complete passion, and also it was something so different from what his regular life was like. And he loved poetry so much. He was absolutely determined to do it. And about 10 years ago, I volunteered, ingratiated myself in various ways, and he allowed me to co-curate with him. So.
Yeah, my impression that the poetry series was always kind of an oasis for Jimmy, away from everything else. Not that the series didn't embrace and discuss issues from his various other life interests and things that he was doing in the city, but as a place where art was being celebrated in a kind of safe, embracing space, I think it was just something that he loved to get there and be a part of and have other people come out and find it and just keep it going.
And he just really loved people, and he was he was really a natural actor.
Yeah.
He had to be given, he was really extraordinary at that, and he had a terrific sense, social radar, and he he loved creating something, and I think he was extraordinarily encouraging to other mm-hmm. poets.
Yeah.
And he, there's so many people who've come up and said, you know, he really inspired me to try to do this.
Mm-hmm. And his sort of creative endeavors with the they don't end with the series. I mean, his poetry and his writing extended into plays, librettos, songs. He was working with musicians, actors all the time for special events and things. Always for charity, always mm-hmm. with a purpose, mm-hmm. Which I think also kind of contributes to the zeal for doing what he was doing, that there was mm-hmm. something behind it, not simply art for art's sake, but there was more of an impetus of using art as a way of communicating, of connecting, which was very important to him.
Yeah.
When he was a Vietnam veteran, and he did a lot of work with veterans. He created some number of special events, and he went down to D.C. and there was that whole part of his life. And so it was really great that the last year, while he was still living, we had a Memorial Day event, and then this year we've had another one. We've had young veterans speaking and reading their poetry, and that's really, he was really happy to see that.
Yeah. Which I think is, and it is this interesting sort of, I don't want to call it maybe double bind or whatever, that the series does seem to embrace. You know, it is this celebration, it is this, it's interesting for me, like, that it's weekly. For me, it's almost now it's become ritualistic. Mm-hmm. You know, I take the 60, 61A or B down to Oakland, because it is in a bar and I can have a beer. Mm-hmm. And then I can take the bus home. You know, it becomes, for me, as even as someone who attends the thing, there is a ritualistic component to it. And people come together and there is this set format. And yet it is this place where people explore very real things. Mm-hmm. You know, it is this mm-hmm. disruption to routine, it's disruption mm-hmm. to mundane life, mm-hmm. which I think is something poetry in particular, I think, is really positioned to do mm-hmm. in our era mm-hmm.
yeah.
and allow us to explore differently, like mm-hmm. very serious, very real things.
Mm-hmm. Well, we there's always been an open mic, and Jimmy always really encouraged people to read the open mic. He always said that was his favorite part of the evening, was to hear someone whom he'd never heard. And a lot of folks who have read over the years started, of course, in the open mic. But the other thing about that space is it's a big space.
Yeah.
You can pack a lot of folks in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's easy, and people can get there by bus, which is great.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so then the other thing I wanted to talk about is, and you're talking about especially something like the open mic, you know, the necessity, the need for institutions to fulfill needs, take care of people. I mean, it's me thinking, like, politically, you know, it's 2019, I think I've known austerity my whole life. You know, the Hemingway's Summer Poetry Series is slightly older than I am.
Okay.
It's just, but only a little.
Okay.
But for someone who was born after the foundation of the Hemingway's Poetry Series, your whole life's been austerity. I mean, I even think about, you know, mm-hmm. How many doors over the course of my life that have closed behind me. Mm-hmm. You know, and you try to leave a stick in the door for mm-hmm. future generations, but it doesn't mm-hmm. necessarily work. And the value, and if you could both talk about what that means to keep something like this going, keeping this platform going, keeping the open mic format as part of it, as far as what does it mean to Pittsburgh, to poetry, to the folks in that room, to you too as well. What does it mean to have this institution and take care of this institution?
Do you want to go first?
Sure. Yeah, I think just starting with the open mic, I mean, it represents access. And so often, I remember very well being a young writer in Pittsburgh, back in the 90s at Pitt, and trying to figure out where the community was and how to enter into it without just being on the sidelines.
Yeah.
And that was very difficult. I had no access back then. I I wasn't attending the series, and I probably should have. That would have been a way in.
Yeah, we all should.
Seriously.
And should have.
But that's something that has always stuck with me in any of the sort of literary artistic endeavors that I've been involved in, whether it was the New Yinzer, the TNY Presents series, Bridge series, whatever. Access, allowing for an open door is so incredibly important. You're talking about how does something like this last for as long as it does? People coming in, new blood, new voices. Mm. You have to have that. If it just becomes a closed circuit, yeah, it's not going to continue, because yeah, eventually people leave, people die, something happens, people get busy, and it falls apart. Yeah. A series like this, which is now a legacy series, without Jimmy, it's clearly a legacy series, it has to do that to survive. It has to keep moving forward, because something can start on the, say, on the, you know, the presence of the person who starts it. It's like it's personality driven, and some things are. For it to continue, once that person is gone, it has to be more than that. And that's, I think the series is showing that.
Yeah.
Clearly, that's the direction, and it's capable of that, and has always been pushing towards that.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, I think that was always Jimmy's intention, was access.
Mm.
As he wasn't a part of any other system or any other sort of poetry group or unit, allowing people to come together and to mix things up, to have university poets, academics, reading with street poets, beginning poets, older poets who are, you know, just doing it in their free times and their retirement.
Yeah.
Having all of those voices together, speaking to each other and speaking to an audience, is incredibly special about the series. Mm-hmm. There aren't many series that can mix up the voices as well as I think Hemingway's has been doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the part of I think what we did the last 10 years when Jimmy and I were working on this together is we expanded the number of readers, because it used to be like one or two readers, and we would then, you know, we sort of talked about this, and we would have readings that were maybe three was the fewest number, and six or seven. It just gave people more opportunity, and we tried some theme readings, which we're doing this year with the Save the Planet, and we did a Stonewall Uprising reading this year, and trying to really reach out and engage people and bring people in who might not even think they are interested in poetry to come and hear poetry.
Yeah.
And something else we have done is about 8 years ago, my partner Don Sturica volunteered to audio record everything.
Oh.
And so we have an archive for the last 8 years.
Wow.
And so anyone, and we've missed like two nights. We couldn't do it, couldn't make it work. But we have everybody recorded, including the open mic readers. And we have photographs the last few years. And so you can really you can see who the readers were. You can hear them. You can hear Ed Ochester from 5 years ago, or Toy Derricotte, or Chris Collins, or, you know, pretty much everybody who's read. And the other thing that I think that was encouraging that Jimmy did, just to get back to something he did that was special, he always would really talked with and praised the young poets or the new poets. He would buy the books of all, you know, he'd always try to buy a book from, he'd sometimes say, do you have $10? You know, can I have $10? I want to buy this book. And so that people really felt validated, and people would come back. And the thing he would always say is this series is inclusive. What we're doing is inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the goal.
Yeah, and just getting back to the audio archive that's online right now, it's a living history of the local poetry community. And if you want to run the gamut of what we've seen in this town and the strength of the literary community and what they produce, there's really no better place to go than to that archive and just listen to those voices as they, some maturing through the years.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And people can download, they can use it for their, they can put it on their website. We really encourage people to do that. Right. Send it to people who might want to hear how you're, what you do, so forth. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. And of course, I will, when I post this into the interwebs, include a link to that archive, so for the folks who are listening can find it from the website, which again, I think is that that necessity of having a platform. Necessity of, I think, the other thing is sort of a child of the Reagan era, you know, and everything that's followed. The way that spaces and institutions, public spaces and institutions have shrunk. And the way that I think what's so special about the series is how self-consciously it leaves the open.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it's interesting you were saying earlier about how Jimmy not being an academic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I know, and my university has, we were just talking about it actually in my kitchen a moment ago. My university has a monthly reading series that's hidden up on campus, and we bring people in, but is it just for the, you know, it's like that accessibility makes me think about, like, we do this thing, but if you're not from my university, do you know about it?
Well, if you send me information on what you're doing, I'll send it to the Poetry Blast.
I will do that. I'm taking that initiative.
About 400 more people will know about it.
You know what? I am going to do that, and when they announce the series, I will make sure
you
at least get the souvenir bookmark.
Oh, great. Thank you.
That's even the weird thing. Is like, and again, austerity, you know, we have posters. I don't always get a poster for the Coffee House series.
Yeah.
I work in that department. I sometimes don't warrant a poster.
I understand.
I got to do things to get the bookmark, you know. But, and I think that, you know, and does that, if you talk about the talent, though, I mean, is it a reciprocal thing? There's such a deep pool. I mean, granted, you know, my institution has a minor in creative writing now. There are three MFA programs in this town.
Oh, golly.
In this town now? Chatham Pitt.
Carlo,
that's the third, right? Chatham Pitt, Carlo. Yeah, that's a deep talent pool, but also how that's reciprocal. Yes, there's a deep talent pool, but there's also a platform for those people.
That's right.
And platforms for those people. And how important it is to put people in a position to flourish.
Well, also people who've read in this series have gone on to create their own series. Bob Wallachy created the Versify series. Kayla and Kayla Sargeson, Lisa Alexander created the Laser Cat. There's, you know, and this is, you know, occasionally somebody emails me and says, oh, this is terrible. There's too many things. You know, how are we going to, you know, keep our, as if we have to have our foot in the door? You know, I'm going like, no, excuse me. This is, this door is open. Mm-hmm. Everybody gets to come through here. And it's great if we have 4 events a night. And there's an audience for, there's an audience for at least 3.
Which, okay, so here's an idea. So for you, so you've been doing this 10 years. This is your first year, Christopher.
But he's done other
series. He's done other series. He's done other
series for the last 15 years.
Yes.
Yeah, so.
Yes, he's a veteran.
All right. So if we're going to embrace this, and if we, this DIY spirit, this do-it-yourself spirit, for folks who want to have a series, what do you do? Like, if for folks listening at home, what
attend
do you do?
Attend some of the other series.
Well, attend some of the other series. Steal ideas.
You can. I always suggest doing what my secret strategy was, which was getting everybody's email, everybody's, and then going out, and which is what I still do is going out and hearing everybody I can hear. And then making notes and then emailing them, getting their bio note.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but you've got to have a place to do these things.
Got
to
find a place.
And you've got to have a place that people can get to.
Mm.
That they're, it's not someplace off in the, in the hinterland, basically, where people aren't going to drive there. They're frankly not going to go. So, and then,
I think that and just studying what other people are doing right now, because I don't think it's enough. I mean, you could do this. Don't listen to me. but I don't think it's simply enough to start a general series at this point. You kind of have to go your own path, figure out what the identity of your series is that you want.
So is there finding a niche, finding a gap?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. What is not being served?
What
right
is
now.
Not being served? Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
Otherwise, you are kind of adding to kind of the white noise of general reading series, which are fine, but you're not going to stand out.
Mm. So what is the preparation for this? Like, how does the summer series come together? What does this...
Well, I can tell you what Jimmy and I did. And okay. Chris and I think we'll be on a somewhat different schedule. But we started in December. And we brainstorm, which meant we talked on the phone, and we'd come up with he'd give me basically his list of who he wanted for sure, and then we'd work it out, and so that's, I do the typing part.
Okay. I don't have a working printer, so that's good.
Okay. And you know, and just and but I think we'll start thinking about this probably this afternoon.
Yes,
we are in fact going to sit down and think about this afternoon.
Oh wow!
Okay, and start to sketch out what you know because there's it's I mean part of the problematic thing is genuinely that you have to address the fact that some people are going to think that they because they read in the series 12 years ago. They're going to have some right to read every year or maybe, you know, there's... And that's, you know, you can't have a series that really grows if it's always the same voices.
Exactly.
It cannot grow. Because you can't pack 20 people on the stage. And it's really important to... It really is important that you're reaching out to people who are gifted and wonderful, but nobody's quite heard them yet.
Yeah. Exactly, yes. For me, like this is, like you said, this is my first year. So this season of the series was already in play before I came aboard. It was already worked out. I'm just kind of along for the ride right now. It's a good ride.
It's a good ride. It's a good learning year.
You start working on these things pretty early. You can't just jump in and think you're going to have a reading series next week that you can continue to sustain. When I was doing other series, it's a good 4 to 5 months before you even start, before the series would even start, that I'd start planning it, at least. Once you have the dates in the space, you start planning it, because you never know. You have to lock down people.
Yeah.
Writers are a squirrely bunch, and sometimes they, you know, things come up, and they have other things they have to do. So you just have to be able to get them locked down or be able to respond quickly. Closer to the date, so it, you know, advance legwork is definitely important for something like this.
And you always have to be. You just realize that every year somebody's not going to be able to be there, and you just hope it's not one of three people who are thought of as crucial.
Right.
You know, but maybe one of perhaps seven. But to be open to that and not have your feelings hurt if somebody gets a fellowship someplace. Mm-hmm. Hey. Yeah. God bless, you know.
Or, you know, a family emergency or an illness or something. Many of the times I've gotten the call that I can't make it tonight. Or I can't make it next week now. And depending on what you have planned, you may have to fill that slot. And maybe you can just let it slide. But sometimes you just have to scramble and fill the slot.
Yeah.
So be prepared.
Be prepared.
Chris has done such a great job of getting out the word out about the series in ways that we had not done using Facebook and Twitter. Yeah. And also Chris does the opening now, which Jimmy always did. And I really value because he does a great opening. He always thinks of something really engaging and heck, almost downright profound sometimes to bring to this so that he...
Ask you about that later.
Okay.
Am I actually doing a good job?
You're doing a doing a great job. And that's... I think we've got a rhythm already working, but it's just... I'm really thrilled to be working with Chris on this. Because I think he brings so much to this.
Which is another part of, you know, having institutions and infrastructure, is that it's all of this that seems invisible, that takes a tremendous amount of effort.
Well, it should seem invisible.
It should seem invisible.
Otherwise,
yeah.
You're just kind of complaining in front of a microphone. Which is fun too. I've done that.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. So I want, and speaking of which, though, and I think this is an interesting dynamic, which what we're talking about and where Jimmy's position, and so. I try to get there early every week. I have a spot now. I think I've staked out my chair.
Yeah.
Don't take it, anybody. Coming to the Hemingway series, but don't sit under the one TV left to the right of the door. That's my spot. And it's just something for me as an educator that I struggle with is, and I find this fascinating. I've witnessed this several times this summer. If you get there around 7:30,
mm-hmm.
you know, before the PA is even set up,
mm-hmm.
You know, there's people in that back room who are just there to be there,
mm-hmm.
and then this thing's happening, and you say that you hand folks the schedule with the bios,
yes,
which is amazing. Which again is also, I think, you know, people. Actually, I think one of the readers from Tuesday was a former student of mine, but I wasn't sure.
Oh, wow.
I almost went up to them after the reading and was like, hey, did you go? But then I was like, wait, what if they didn't have kind memories of me?
Well, who was that guy? Yes.
Oh, you. Oh, yeah, your class sucked. But, you know, this way of, like, so people be there. And you'll say in the most kindest, loving, inviting way, you'll hand them, like, oh, you're staying for the poetry? They flee. Like, you see, like, these dude bros who are like, oh man, I'm gonna get out of here. Like,
well, actually, sometimes they stay.
Sometimes they stay,
and,
but I've noticed
sometimes,
this.
Oh, sure. I mean, they yeah. young people have some place to go, and they're
Young people have some place to go, but also I find this. So I do like an orientation of how to read. Like I teach this writing about literature course, and I spend the first week on what are we looking for? How do we create new knowledge? How do we think about books?
Mm-hmm.
And I always end on, I show them cartoons, actually. Like, I give them a list of heuristics of what I think are the 55 questions literary scholars use. And I was like, here's the menu. This is what I do professionally. Now you got to do it, too. And I show them cartoons. And the last one I always do is an animated interpretation of Robert Frost's Pan with Us, which I don't think is a particularly obtuse poem.
Oh, wow.
And just the fact that it is in stanzas, it's terrifying. It's utterly, and I think it's so interesting, like the way, you know, and Jimmy as a figure, because of his other lives.
Yes.
And how this series, and like, what do we do? Because poetry is this vital, like, you know, people live their lives without art, in a weird way. We have entertainment. We have escapist cinema. We do, in our culture, we do that so super well.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that helps understand the mysteries of experience the way the historic forms are. And I just think about how, like, people have been almost sort of conditioned away from those things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, but like superhero movies, right? I mean, they're good. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to watch those, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and you're supposed
yeah.
to.
Yeah.
But it's so interesting to me. And it's also, it's like, how do I work through that with my students? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, for a long time back when I was at a different institution where the students had more off-campus lives, I used to introduce poetry through, there's a Maurice Kilwine Guevara poem called When the Light Turned Red, which is Saturday in the Strip District in about 33 lines.
Wow.
One stanza of 33 lines, literally this right. moment when this red light on Penn turns red. And
oh, wow.
all of the things that you experience. And it's this moment, like I hand that out to, and I would have students who would just look up and go, this is what this is. Okay, this is what this is supposed to do.
Yeah.
Poetry. And I don't know, I haven't found anything that appeals to my current mm-hmm. white suburban student body quite so much.
Well, I mean, almost anywhere I go, especially if I'm in a coffee house, I'll go up to the barista and say, are you a poet?
Mm-hmm.
And about half the time, they either are a poet or they're an artist.
Yeah.
Mm. And then I'll get their email.
Wow.
and so I'm
that's
you know I'm
you
working
work
to I'm working to build this audience. And I think there are many. I mean, I was part of a writer's lab in high school,
mm.
and some of the most kids who you think might not be even interested in literature were in that writer's lab, and they were they'd kind of, you know, they'd come in and then they'd be writing really interesting material. And so, some of my students over the years, because I was a teacher for a lot of years, you know, you can't tell who's going to be a poet, who's going to have some story they need to tell. And if you give them a chance. And that was why I think Jimmy was so great, in that he was writing about subjects you don't think, you know, he was writing about the street.
Yeah. I mean, poetry is a weird form that we use. It's interesting that you say that your students sort of have a kind of panicked reaction to seeing stanzas later.
Yeah. Almost that it's supposed to be obtuse.
Yeah.
Like, they'll read a stanza, totally get it, and go, and be still alienated from it. Like, because
it's
what
it is.
This can't be it. Yeah. This can't be what this is about.
Yeah.
You can write poems about these things?
Yeah. Like, my buddy, the poet Jonathan Moody, in his classes, he was teaching like high school classes, and he said that when he would present free verse to people, no stanzas, you know, no rhyme, they freaked out. They didn't know how to deal with that. So I think both of those things just sort of consolidate a public misunderstanding or apprehension about what poetry is, that if it isn't the stanza thing, you don't know how to deal with it, but as the stanza thing, it's poetry, so you don't know how to deal with it. So, it's a very odd form to choose to communicate with people when there's such a vast kind of cultural disconnect with the form itself and the elasticity of the form.
Yeah.
And the meaning that can be woven into it or just laid out on the surface. Like Jimmy's poems, he was right there on the surface. You didn't have to dig very hard to figure out who the narrow fellow in the glass is. Jimmy was like, it's a damn snake. Let me tell you about this snake. It's snake's an asshole. I'm going to write about it. it is just as a choice or a compulsion to write and perform poetry is endlessly fascinating to me just because of that cultural kind of relationship with it. But if you are in a room where somebody is reading a poem to you, say Jimmy or Joan or any of the folks at the series, it becomes much more of a one-on-one moment where you are being communicated to, and whatever the art of the poem that's being read or expressed, there's something else going on. That's the power of reading, as opposed to reading something on the page. They are different experiences.
Yeah.
And should be considered kind of different things in a way. It's if you can get people out and just open-minded enough to sit for 10, 20 minutes and listen to somebody, they tend to come away surprised, I've found. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, I didn't know that's what you could do as a poet. It's like, I didn't know. I wouldn't recognize that as poetry if I saw it, but it is, clearly.
Mm-hmm. And every week is different. I mean, we're not doing the same sort of, they're different, you know. Every week, I think, is a fresh set of voices and an interesting combination, and it's nice to do things that surprise people.
Yeah, it's nice to get voices in there that haven't read together, because you get a nice frisson going on between somebody, an older poet, a younger poet, academic, whatever. Once they're mixed up and those ideas and approaches to the form start bouncing off one another, then you've got a conversation happening, and I think a very interesting conversation about the culture, the state of the art form, what you're doing as far as a performance, all of that thing comes into play, and it becomes a profoundly interesting experience. Like, I always, as long as I've been doing this, as we were talking about earlier, the behind the scenes nuts and bolts of a thing, they can wear you down a bit, and you get frustrated, and I get frustrated fairly easily sometimes with that sort of thing. But every night that I'm in a room, either as a reader or as an audience member, it's very clear to me why I keep coming back to it and why it's so important. And particularly now, it's such a kind of spiritual salve.
Yeah.
Not that it it doesn't calm me.
Yeah.
So much as it reminds me, oh yeah, this is what people are like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is what we can do, and this how we express ourselves to one another. That's right. It's not hopeless entirely.
Yeah, well, I think for me it's also one of the things that's driving me more towards kind of this. I'm you know, you think about big superhero movie, like those people, those figures, all of that. I mean, you can buy that ticket and have the slice of that experience, but it's so inaccessible. I'm finding myself at this, you know, in the late 20-teens doing this thing where I go to the music shows where I can talk to the bands afterwards because they're at the merch table, or I know the people in the bands, you know, and it's becoming now, it is becoming, what am I reading? Well, you know, who do I know?
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, which is in some ways kind of maybe a bit provincial, you know. You know, I read Pittsburgh is what I read, and I listen to Pittsburgh. But also it's maybe so much more, there's a humanity to that.
Yeah.
And there's a humanity to a reading series like the Hemingway Summer series because of that. And I think about, you know, if you want to think about the urban-rural divide, because I was, you know, this last episode of the podcast was recorded in the country, in Trump country, and interacting with people there who are so disconnected from something like this and people who are doing creative things or people who are shaping the world. And there's a, you know, it's the mad mean Mother Joad talks about in Grapes of Wrath. Wow. You know, it's and I think there's a powerlessness that people have to that if they don't have something like this ready for them, because they don't know that people are making things or having thoughts, feelings, confronting them with ideas, which is,
well, it's important that, I mean, I think there are many places for de Tocqueville spoke about this. He wrote about this. He wrote about part of why America worked when he came to see America, was that there were so many places where people came together, and that there were, you know, what we would call like the Elks, or I mean, there were there were community organizations, there were churches, there were places. I mean, it is very easy to feel very alone in 21st century America, and have a sense of anger and powerlessness. And that's tough.
Yeah.
And so when you can bring together people and let them hear material that resonates with them, with something in their life, or opens them up to something they hadn't maybe thought about before, and have just a place to gather. It is, that is a safe space.
Yeah.
And that different points of view can be expressed and listened to with respect. That's really important.
So speaking of which, so we're in the middle of the season, aren't we?
We're
talking 20, and the internet is forever. So this is, we're talking 2019.
We're actually coming up on July the 2nd will be our next reading, and so we're actually 2/3 of the way through.
Oh, 2/3. So traditionally, the series runs
May, first Tuesday of May to the last Tuesday of July. So it's it's 13 weeks.
13 weeks.
Yeah, usually, yeah.
So what's coming up in 2019? What is left?
Woohoo! Okay.
Yes. Now it's time for the hard sell.
Okay. This is just, what we've got is going to be great, and all your listeners should be there, even if you have to sit on the floor.
There's
extra, but not always. But this coming Tuesday, it's going to be Shaheen Dil, Lyubomir Nikolov, who's a Bulgarian poet, Judith Robinson, and Michael Worster. And the week after, it's going to be the 9th.
And so the week after is the...
The 9th.
The 9th.
It's going to be Nancy Krygowski, Richard St. John, and Samuel Hazo. And do you want to read the rest of it?
Sam Hazo.
Sure. And Tuesday, July 16th, we'll have Lynn Emanuel, Lauren Russell, and Toy Derricotte.
Woohoo!
On the 23rd, we've got the, who do we have? Jennifer Jackson Berry, Jay Carson, Robin Clark, Barbara Duarte.
Robin's been on the podcast.
I'm going to skip that. Esaldo.
Escalabo.
Escalabo. Adam Macho and John Stoop.
Oh, wow, Adam Macho.
And then the 30th is the finale, which I curated. I've been doing the finales for the last couple of years, hosting and curating those. And this time around, we've got Jen Ashburn, Jason Baldinger, Dina November, Disha Filia, Adriana Ramirez, Ellen McGrath-Smith, all Bridge Series folks, plus the addition of Don Wentworth.
Don Wentworth. Wow.
Oh, it's going to be great.
That is going to be great. And that's going to be 2019. Internet is forever. But 2020, 2021, 2022, first Tuesday in May to last Tuesday in July.
Yes.
For the future. Forever.
Yes.
Forever.
We sure hope so, yes.
That's the idea.
That's the idea.
And like I said, so you can find out, there'll be links. There is a Hemingway's Summer Poetry Series Facebook. There is a Hemingway's Poetry Series blogspot, which I'll have links to when we post this. And of course, and part of that, there is the archive of the last 5 years?
Eight years
audio archive for those of you who missed it, or who are also not local. So
that's right. Yes. And people, some of my friends in California, tune in.
Oh, and so can
and
you.
Photos. Or, yes. And there are photos.
And there's photos. So on that happy note, I think it's time for the bottom five.
Okay.
All right. All right. Bottom five. Series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. And since we have two co-curators here, the wrinkle is, as always, when we have more than one person, that you must come to consensus. You must come to consensus on your answer.
Okay.
All right. So, and since, you've gotten this question before, Christopher, but now, Jones, first time on the podcast, the classic first question everybody gets the first time. If reincarnation was real, and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease or illness would you be?
I've never been asked that one before.
You know, most people haven't. Well, you have, Chris.
I've been asked that several times, in fact.
Okay.
Infectious disease.
Or illness. If you had to go single cell again.
Well, what did you, honey? Just tell me what you said last time, okay?
What did I say last time?
I got it in that filing cabinet there. If you want to look it up.
An infectious disease. Oh.
It can be the common cold. You can be cold sores. You can be.
I don't want to be any of those things.
Gut bacteria that people need to live. That's been popular.
Okay. Well, gut bacteria that people need to live is not a bad idea.
Intestinal flora.
Yeah, perhaps intestinal flora. Or being part of the guts of it all.
Yeah.
Okay. There we go. All right. Question two. This was a 50-50 question. If you had to choose, would you welcome the total elimination of day or night?
Oh, dear God. Well, night.
Yeah, I'd have to go with, well, that's tough. Yeah, I'll go along with night.
So perpetual daylight.
Yeah, whole insomnia kind of experience.
Yeah, sure. That's, you know. That's why God invented blind, you know, things to grow your
right.
eyes.
Yeah, no, that's right. And you can still grow food.
You can grow food. Well, that's a plus.
Yeah.
And it is easier to, you know, go for your lattes when it's,
Yeah,
long distance driving is better during the day.
Yeah, I've never been able to work at night, so. I'd go with day.
I think it's very good for plants. I think it's a big plus for plants.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Question three. This is another standard question, which Christopher, I'm sure you've gotten before. Joan, you haven't. Of the living villains of history, whose obituary would you most like to write? And why? And this can go a lot of ways. This can be, you know, I stole this question from Christopher Hitchens' book, Mortality. Yeah. you know, where he said his first thought was, man, I was really looking forward to someday reading Henry Kissinger and Cardinal Ratzinger's obituaries. And he said, wait, I wanted to write those. In his, you know, dancing on the grave sort of way, or we can talk about people's Faustian bargains when they went wrong and try to humanize them, but of the living villains of history, what really, Joan Bauer, Christopher Collins obituary would...
I really don't want to make a political comment here, but one name does come to mind.
Yeah, it's hard to resist that.
It's hard to resist that name. It has RUMP. It has five letters, and it starts with a T.
Yeah.
And it ends with a P.
The Orange Menace that shall not be named.
Yeah. Who shall not be named. But as a pacifist and as someone who always believes...
Well, you know, again, they...
I know I'm not...
Yeah, I mean, they would just, you know, people slip in the shower and...
But I deeply, you know, I think since I believe so much in the political process, the importance of voting, I think that's the way you encourage people to depart.
Mm.
So that they're only the living dead.
Mm.
So, yeah, Christopher Hitchens, you know, used to hang out at Pitt. He was a big... good friends with many fellows, and I have friends who used to drink with Christopher Hitchens.
Oh, wow!
And I'm a huge Christopher Hitchens fan, so it's nice for you to mention him.
Yeah, book is right. Actually, that book is right there on the wall.
Yes, great.
On my little religious studies shelf, weirdly. He's one, three volumes above the Bible, right above a collection of World War II war poems.
Ooh.
Yeah, anyway. All right, so the Orange Menace shall not be named. All right, question four. If you could unmake any invention, what would it be? There's just something, some technology you could take out of the human experience.
I can say as a pretty recent... new father, that whoever invented baby pajamas with nothing but snaps all up and down both legs, that's one, an obituary of a person I'd like to write, if they're still living, because it is just, it's a horrible, horrible invention. Zippers, just zippers. That's all you need.
Now that's really interesting. I had always thought snaps were okay.
Snaps are fine, except for the onesies that have them like down both legs, and then there are like 30 snaps that you have to.
Oh dear.
Go. Oh dear.
Gee,
and those legs
move.
I
didn't just send one to my grand nephew.
if the child is a placid child and not eager to kick, then you're fine with that. But. I have a very energetic little boy.
Well, I think that's a really important point of view, and I certainly wouldn't have thought of it.
So that's where I would go on that. That's,
okay.
That is currently my least favorite invention.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will go with you on that.
All right.
Okay.
All right. It's a movement now.
It's a movement now. Yes, there's two people.
We can bring in examples of these and see how this is really bad. Do not support
the zipper is such a fine invention.
The zippers,
it's a bit nerve wracking with a baby.
Mm.
The zipper,
yeah.
But they're stretchy. You can just stretch the zipper. It's nowhere near the skin, as opposed to those snaps, which then you don't
really
know which snap
good.
Goes where. Oh my God!
Oh,
and you gotta do it fast
because
you don't want them going. Wah!
Yeah, exactly.
Oh wow!
And if you have to do it in the dark. Like in the middle of the
night
changing a diaper?
Oh,
my God.
Forget it.
Oh,
it's over.
The
it's
level
over.
Of difficulty.
Well, see, this is really important. I'm really glad you shared that. Because I sure wouldn't have thought of it.
Yeah, me neither.
Go, guy.
There you go.
All right. Question five, then. We're almost out of this.
Okay.
Question five. Okay. Imagine... we're living in a dystopian future, not the dystopian future we are currently inhabiting, but something far worse.
Yeah,
and the
far worse.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where the only books to survive would be those bound in human skin. And so if there was a great book roundup happening and then the only books surviving are the ones bound in human skin, would you? And what book would you donate your skin for? And the Bible, the Quran, and the complete works of Shakespeare, those are... somebody already got those. Those are safe choices.
That's a
don't
lot
pick
of,
those.
A lot of skin.
That's a lot of
Shakespeare.
Skin.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot of skin. So somebody's on Shakespeare, the Bible, the Quran. Would you? In what book? And so if you don't do this, there's the risk this book does not survive in the future human history.
Well, one of the books I'm very fond of is Joseph Brodsky's book of essays called Less Than One. And you might not have read it.
No.
Tremendously fond of Joseph Brodsky. He was a dear friend of Anna Akhmatova. He was thrown out of Russia basically because he was seen as a malcontent, and all he really was a fairly independent-minded poet. And he ended up winning the Nobel Prize for Literature and becoming very fluent in English. And I just devoted to him. And there's a wonderful film about him, interviews, and it can be found. And I guess I'm just such a Brodsky here fan that I would consider it. I'm not sure. I have rather wrinkly skin, but they could probably find some that would be nice.
The book would just have texture.
Okay, that's we have some that has extra texture.
Yeah, I can't argue against Brodsky. I think personally, I'd go for Frank O'Hara's Lunch Poems.
Ah,
it's a small book.
It's a small book.
It wouldn't require a lot of skin.
It wouldn't. Well,
you can maybe graft it back on. Yeah, you might survive that process.
I think Frank O'Hara's Lunch Poems are really wonderful. Yeah. Maybe we could do both.
Sure.
I think so.
And on that happy note, I think that's about it. Again, so Hemingway's poetry series, that's Hemingway's in Oakland on Forbes Avenue. You folks have Google Maps and
3911
stuff.
3911 Forbes Avenue. You have to really look for it.
Oh,
you
yeah.
can walk by and be confused.
Yes.
And so
that's right.
Just look at the window. Okay. It does say Hemingway's.
If you walk in and there are donuts on display, you've gone a little too far.
You've gone too far. But we're in the back room.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
All the way in the back of the bar.
All the way in the back.
We don't run the pub quiz that is often happening at the same time.
Yes.
That's right. And you do have to be over 21. You can't
there's a guy at the door.
There's
a guy at the door. So wait, what's that address again?
3911 Forbes Avenue.
39 Forbes Avenue, Tuesday nights.
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock, second Tuesday in May, last Tuesday in
July.
First Tuesday in May. First Tuesday in May. Wow.
13
too
weeks.
Bad I don't edit this thing.
Okay. It'll be great, and feel free to get a beer, get some food, mm-hmm. and come early.
There's
get a good seat.
Sign there's what
the
six
mic.
Seven stay for the open mic, sign up for the open mic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Check out the Facebook page, check out the audio archive on the Blogspot page. I'll have links to all of that stuff. Hemingway's Legacy Series, 45 years important Pittsburgh cultural institution.
Thank you, Matt.
You're welcome. So our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. Our homepage where you can find new and old episodes is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're on, I guess, Apple Podcasts now is the name of the thing, Google Play Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podcast Addict, and when I remember, Mixcloud. Follow us on Twitter at Gonna Die Podcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thank you again, Joan Bauer, Christopher Collins. Go to the Hemingway Summer Series. Later, meets.
Woohoo! Yay!